Welcome to week three of our series called The Old Story. If you're hopping in new, we're finishing out the summer with this series, and the goal here is we are moving through the book of Acts, and we're looking at how the first followers of Jesus communicated their faith, specifically how they communicated this old story that we affectionately refer to as the gospel of Jesus Christ. And there's really two goals that undergird this series. Number one, as we look at these different gospel presentations, the hope, of course, is that the gospel would sink more deeply into our lives, because that's how we change as followers of Jesus. It's not through more effort on our part. It's as the gospel of Jesus's effort, the news of his effort on our behalf, sinks more deeply into our lives. But the other goal of this series is a little bit more practical. The hope is that as we look at these different gospel presentations, ways that the gospel was presented to groups of people, that it'll give us more wisdom and more confidence so that we can skillfully communicate the gospel to the people that God's placed in our lives. And if you're a part of this series from here on out, we're going to conclude at the end of August, what you're going to see, we're going to look specifically at Paul preaching the gospel in tailor-made ways to very specific groups of people. We're going to see how Paul explained the gospel message to people who were deeply religious, who had a robust understanding of Hebrew scriptures but didn't know Christ. We're going to see how he explained the gospel to people who were purely pagan, never read a Bible verse in their life. We're going to see how he communicated the gospel to kind of culturally elite, intellectual juggernauts in the city of Athens, which was really the intellectual capital, not just of the Roman Empire, but in some senses of the planet at the time. And then lastly, before we're done here, we're going to look at how Paul communicated the gospel to the most powerful, the power brokers of his day, men like Herod Agrippa. And so today, we're looking at how Paul tailor-made a gospel presentation for people who were deeply religious, which is why, if you're joining us online, you may have seen the title of this message is called The Story to the Religious. So we find it in Acts chapter 13, we'll be in verses 26 through 39. It says, "Brothers, sons of Abraham's race, and those among you who fear God, the message of this salvation has been sent to us. For the residents of Jerusalem and their rulers, since they did not recognize him or the voices of the prophets that are read every Sabbath, have fulfilled their words by condemning him. Though they found no grounds for the death penalty, they asked Pilate to have him killed. When they'd fulfilled all that had been written about him, they took him down from the tree and put him in a tomb. But God raised him from the dead. And he appeared for many days to those who came with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who were now his witnesses to the people. And we ourselves proclaim to you the good news of the promise that was made to our ancestors. God has fulfilled this for us, their children, by raising up Jesus. As it is written in the second psalm, 'You were my son, today I have become your father.' Since he raised him from the dead, never to return to decay, he has spoken in this way, 'I will grant you the faithful covenant blessings made to David.' Therefore, he also says in another passage, 'You will not allow your Holy One to see decay.' For David, after serving his own generation in God's plan, fell asleep, was buried with his fathers, and decayed. But the one God raised up did not decay. Therefore, let it be known to you, brothers, that through this man, forgiveness of sins is being proclaimed to you, and everyone who believes in him is justified from everything that you could not be justified from through the law of Moses." This is God's word. What we're looking at this morning is it's an excerpt from Paul's first recorded sermon after becoming a follower of Jesus. And one of the things that makes this particular sermon so meaningful is it gives us a kind of behind-the-scenes look at how the first followers of Jesus understood and how they talked about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And two things that are crystal clear about Paul's message here is that the first followers of Jesus understood the resurrection of Jesus Christ in at least two ways. They understood it as a historical fact, and secondly, they understood it as a fulfillment of a promise. And so we're going to look at Paul's message through those two lenses today. And with that, we'll just get right into our first idea, because we got a lot of ground to cover. First idea here is that the resurrection should be understood as a fact. So I'm going to look again just at verses 30 and 31. You'll see where this idea comes from. It says, "But God raised Jesus from the dead, and Jesus appeared for many days to those who came with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who were now his witnesses to the people." So Paul is saying two things there. He's saying, first off, that Jesus was physically raised from the dead, and secondly, that there are a whole lot of people who were eyewitnesses of Jesus' resurrected body. So the point is, most obviously, that Paul did not teach and the first followers of Jesus did not understand the resurrection as an image or as a metaphor. They understood it as a cold, hard, concrete historical fact. And I don't think there's anybody on the planet that would have not wanted the resurrection to be true more than Paul. If you know about Paul's story, you know, prior to becoming a Christian, he hated Christianity. He was violent toward Christians. He exercised his influence to stamp out Christianity before it spread any further because Christianity represented a threat to everything that he believed, the foundation of his life and the way that he was taught to relate to God. To explain what I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard this before, but this might surprise you to hear. In the Roman Empire, Christians, our people, were actually called atheists. I don't know if you've ever heard that. But when they put Christians to death in the arena, they used to chant, "Death to the atheists." And they called Christianity not a religion, but an anti-religion. Now, that sounds very strange in our culture because Christians are kind of seen as, you know, overtly religious people. It's the opposite back then. But if you kind of hop into the mind of the average Roman citizen 2,000 years ago, I think it's you can begin to understand why they would assume that Christians were atheists. So the average Roman citizen 2,000 years ago was a polytheist. They had all kinds of gods. They had probably a number of household gods in their own home that they would burn incense to try to honor and try to earn the favor of. And then depending on what they wanted in their life, they had a Greek god or a Roman god that they would make a particular sacrifice to. And, you know, depending on the temple that you worshiped at, there would be different prescriptions for how they do that. So if this average Roman citizen, just imagine this conversation, imagine he's walking along the road one day and he meets a Christian and he hears about this new religion, this new way of life called Christianity. And so he asks the Christian, "Hey, I've heard a lot about you guys, that you follow some Galilean, or was he a Nazarite, or I don't know who it was. His name's Jesus, apparently. Tell me more about that. Where do you Christians worship? Where's your temple?" What the Christian would have said was, "Well, we don't actually have a temple, because Jesus said that he was the final temple." That's John chapter 2. Jesus said that his body was a temple that would be torn down, but he himself would rebuild it in just 3 days, referring to his resurrected body. So we don't actually have a temple. So the Roman citizen responds, "Okay, well, if you don't have a temple, then how do you all do your sacrifices?" And the Christian would say, "We actually don't do sacrifices because Jesus was also our final sacrifice for sin. We don't have to keep sacrificing for sin because he paid for that once forever." And so the Roman citizen says, "Well, that's interesting, but if you don't have sacrifices, then what do your priests do all day?" And the Christian would say, "We don't actually have any priests because, you're not going to believe this, Jesus is also our final high priest. We don't rely on any human being to usher us into the presence of God. Jesus has accomplished that for us." And so the Roman citizen would say, "Okay, so you're a part of a religion that doesn't have a temple, doesn't have a sacrificial system, and doesn't have priests? That's not a religion." And technically speaking, that Roman citizen would have been right. From that, they called us atheists. I say that to say, every religion that anyone's ever thought of in human history has had those three things. They've had a place of worship. They've had a way that you worship, the sacrificial system. They've had a person that brings you into that mode of worship. Christians came along and they said, "We don't need any of those things because Jesus takes care of all those things." And I'm saying all this to say, Paul, as a Pharisee, would have found that about as offensive a message as possible. Why? Because it was spitting in the face of everything that he'd been raised in. It was directly challenging everything that he'd known all his life about how we're supposed to relate to God and be made right with God. So Paul was deeply offended by Christianity. But then he became a Christian because when he saw Jesus on the road to Damascus and was literally knocked on his back, suddenly it didn't matter how offended Paul was by Christianity. It didn't matter how much he hated Christianity. It didn't matter how much Christianity challenged his way of life. He had to believe it for one specific reason, because it was true. Because it was a historical fact. That's the only way you can explain Paul's conversion of Christianity. And really, it's the only way you can explain the meteoric rise of Christianity with first century Jewish men and women like Paul. I don't know if you've ever thought about this before, but historians point out it's an astounding thing. This is actually one of the greatest apologetics for the truth of Christianity. It is astounding that Christianity took off like it did, specifically with first century Jewish people, because they were the last people on the planet to believe what Christianity most foundationally asserts, which is that a human being could be God. That's Christianity 101. Jesus is fully man, but he's fully God at the very same time. That idea was not just ridiculous to Jewish people, it was deeply offensive to Jewish people. That's why if you follow Jesus' life to the end in the gospel accounts, they make it plain, the offense that finally cost Jesus his life was claiming to be divine. It was when he was on trial, at the midnight trial, hours before the crucifixion, their testimonies aren't agreeing with each other, they're lying about Jesus, they're trying to get him executed for something, nobody's agreeing, and they finally ask him, are you God's son? Meaning, are you the divine entered into human history? And Jesus answered simply, you have said it. And when Jesus answered in the affirmative, they tore their robes, they cried blasphemy, the trial was over, they had everything that they needed. That's what cost Jesus' life. I'm saying this to make the case, and this is what historians point out, if you were going to invent a religion with which to mislead first century Jewish people, you'd never come up with something that sounds like Christianity because they'd be the last people on the planet to believe it, and yet they did believe it. Dozens believed it. And then hundreds believed it, and then thousands believed that, and watch this, and they believed it, even though doing so for the first several centuries in the Roman Empire, following Jesus, standing up and saying, I'm a Christian, and getting baptized would cost you your possessions, it would cost you your relationships. For a lot of followers of Jesus, it cost them their lives. So the point is, something had to have happened to get all of these people that were raised in a way that set them up to hate Christianity, to reject Christianity, to despise Christianity, some profound event must have occurred to get them to suddenly abandon what they were raised in and throw in with Jesus, despite the fact that they had nothing to gain and everything to lose by doing so. And the thing, the profound event that occurred is what we refer to as the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's the most plausible explanation for why the early church got off the ground in the first place. So let me conclude point one like this. There's a lot of people, particularly in our day and age, there's a lot of people who will say, I could never become a Christian because, and they'll cite one particular teaching of Christianity that they find personally offensive. They don't like what God teaches about sexuality. They don't like what God teaches about generosity. They don't like what God teaches about the fact that we have to love and pray for and serve even people who have caused us a tremendous amount of pain. They don't like following Jesus means it's not okay to be racist. It's not okay to be prejudiced. You have to actually love people who are deeply different. You know, there's some teaching about Christianity that they don't like, and so they say, because I'm offended by this one particular teaching, I could never be a Christian. To that mindset, let's just take a second here as we conclude point one. Let's think about the Apostle Paul. Paul was deeply offended by Christianity. I think it's safe to say Paul was more offended by Christianity than any of us are, so offended that he was murdering Christians. None of us have been that offended yet. Okay, when you look at Paul's story, his entry into the faith, here's what's clear. Paul did not become a Christian because he suddenly liked everything Christianity taught. He didn't become a Christian because he suddenly went through everything that offended him and decided, actually, that's not all that offensive. If that's how he had approached it, then he would have never become a Christian. What Paul did is he looked at the historical fact of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And you have to start there. If Jesus Christ, see the primary question, and then we'll end point one with this. The primary question that the Bible demands an answer to is not what do I think of everything the Bible teaches? The primary question, although hear me, of course that's important, but the primary, the first and most important question that all of Christianity demands you and I have an answer to is Jesus who he claimed to be? That's what matters. Did Jesus successfully predict and pull off his own death and resurrection because he actually is God? If Jesus did not rise from the grave, then Paul himself said, writing to the Corinthians, we of all people are most to be pitied. Let's hang it up. Let's go home. Nothing in this book deserves further consideration if Jesus is not alive, if Jesus is not who he claimed to be. But if he is, if he did rise again, 3 days later, and he has ascended to the right hand of the throne of God, and he is ruling and reigning over human history, and he will return and render all accounts settled in the end, then now all of a sudden, everything in this book deserves our careful attention. So first and foremost, the resurrection should be understood as a fact. That's the first thing Paul's sermon shows us. The second is going to be our second, and it'll actually be our last idea this morning. It's number two, the resurrection should be understood as fulfillment. So you look at verses 32 and 33. It says, "And we ourselves proclaim to you the good news of the promise that was made to our ancestors." God has fulfilled this. He's fulfilled this promise for us, their children, by raising up Jesus. So what Paul's saying here is that the resurrection was just, it was not just a naked display of Jesus' power. It was an event that marked the beginning of the fulfillment of a promise that God has made in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, there's lots of promises God made in the Old Testament, but what they all have in common, if you read Genesis to Malachi as it's laid out and you're in my Bible, what they all have in common, every promise God makes from Genesis to the end of the Old Testament, is these promises are about the future. God promised that somehow, we don't have any idea how he's going to do it until we get to Jesus, but God has promised that somehow he will make right what we have made wrong. He will find a way to bring us back to where we were in the garden into a perfect relationship with him, with each other, in a creation that is unstained by sin and evil and death and suffering and injustice and everything that we intuitively sense is wrong with this world. Paul's saying the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the beginning of the fulfillment of that promise. Now, pause and consider something. It is an amazing thing to consider that the Roman Empire, powerful as it was, existed for around 1,000 years. You know, we're basically a newborn nation compared to the Roman Empire. It is an amazing thing to consider that despite the fact that the Roman Empire had been around for that long, it had been dominant for that long, that it was completely transformed by Christianity in just the span of about 2 or 3 centuries. That's a historical fact. So Jesus was murdered by crucifixion around 33 AD. You can Google this when you go home. In the year 380, the Roman Emperor Theodosius declared Christianity the official belief system of the Roman Empire. So consider that. Rome went, in 350 years, Rome went from murdering the founder of Christianity to publicly announcing the truth of Christianity. That begs the question, how did Christians pull that off? They didn't have any military might. They didn't have any political influence. So how did Christianity transform that empire and then eventually go to all nations, tribes, and tongues? The answer, according to a lot of historians and theologians, is what we're talking about today. It's the doctrine of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, because the resurrection of Jesus and all of its implications, it was unlike anything the world had ever heard before. It promised more than any other major religion or belief system or way of life had ever dared to promise before. And the resurrection and its implications fulfills the deep longings of the heart unlike anything else that's ever been proposed. So in the rest of our time together, what I want to try to do is explain to you why the resurrection is such a life-changing message. It's because it meant 4 things 2,000 years ago that it still means today. We're going to spend the rest of our time talking about these 4 things. I'll tell you what they are on the front end. First off, the resurrection means that there is a future beyond this life. Secondly, the resurrection means that the future that Jesus has made available to us is a future of love, a future in which we could have love without parting, love without end. Thirdly, the resurrection means that we can have confidence we're actually going to take part in that future, because it doesn't depend on us and our goodness, it depends on Jesus and his, and he's got enough for all of us. Lastly, fourthly, the resurrection means that regret will never have the final word. So in the remaining time that we have together, let me walk through these 4 implications, and then we'll close. First and foremost, what does the resurrection mean? The resurrection means that there is a future. All right, so kind of as a thought experiment, let's think about it this way. In Paul's day, no modern technological advancements. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get us all into the position of we're hearing this message for the first time, like Paul's audience is here. In Paul's day, how would you know if a place existed or what that place was like if you had never been there? There's only one answer to that question. There's only one way you could know. You would need somebody to go to that place and then come back from that place and tell you what it was like. That's the only way that you can know. And I say this to say that's what the resurrection was for people regarding the afterlife in the first century. So in the ancient world, you can even see this in the Old Testament, but we see it in all over the place in lots of different religions. In the ancient world, No one was very confident. Most people believed that there was some kind of afterlife. We had like some kind of sense. Scripture says that God has set eternity in our hearts. That's Ecclesiastes. But no one had any confidence about what it was like. You know, if it was good, if it was bad, what we were supposed to do or how we were supposed to live in order to get to the good version. So there was a general insecurity about what was waiting for us and kind of a general pessimism about it. Well, into that culture, along came this group of people called Christians that were talking about this thing called the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And what they were asserting was that a man who was God had actually overcome death for us. So remember, when Jesus died by crucifixion in Calvary, that wasn't done in a corner. That's what Paul goes on to say to Herod Agrippa. We're going to look at that in the final week of this series. Jesus did not die in a corner. Jerusalem was swelled with the Passover celebration. Thousands of people were there. They all saw Jesus publicly humiliated and executed on Mount Calvary for all eyes to see. They knew that he died. They saw his body stripped naked, taken down from that cross, wrapped up and laid in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. They all knew what happened. And then 3 days later, all of a sudden, hundreds and hundreds of people were all saying, "We saw this man alive and well." Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15 that Jesus, on one occasion, on one occasion, he appeared to over 500 people in his resurrected body. So we had thousands of people see Jesus die, and then all of a sudden, hundreds and thousands were all claiming to be eyewitnesses of the resurrection. So what this means is, for the first time in history, we had somebody that had gone where we had never come back from. He had entered into death, Jesus did, and he came back to tell us what was like. So what the resurrection meant for people, first and foremost, is it gave us this surefire confidence that this life is not all there is, that there actually is something beyond this life. That's the first implication of the resurrection. But more than just showing us that there was something beyond this life, the resurrection of Jesus shows us that the future that he's made available to us is a future of love. All right, follow me here. In Paul's day, if I got any Greek experts in the audience, you'll appreciate this. But in Paul's day, there was a Greek philosopher named Epicurus who taught something that people, even in our culture 2,000 years later, still believe. Epicurus taught that when you die, you simply stop existing. You rot. Once you draw your final breath, that's the it. There's no consciousness. There's no anything beyond this life. There was another group of Greek philosophers called the Stoics who were also very influential in Paul's day. They taught more like Eastern belief systems teach today, Hinduism and Buddhism. They taught that when you die, you don't stop existing altogether, but you do lose the illusion of your individuality. So they taught that what happens after you die is you cease to be an individual, you enter into the all soul of the world, you're like a drop of water returning to the ocean. So Epicurus, on the one hand, said, hey, you don't need to be afraid of death because when you die, there's nothing. You know, there's no existence. The Stoics, they said, you don't have to be afraid of death because when you die, there's a non-personal existence. Let me just point out something. Here's what those two visions of the future have in common. You got to follow me here for this point to make any sense. What those two visions of the future have in common is there's no possibility of love there. All right, if your vision of the future is one of non-existence, you're dead altogether, you're gone altogether, or a non-personal existence, you're not an individual, no one else is an individual anymore. What those two visions of the future have in common is there's no possibility of love, and here's why that matters. We are relational creatures made in the image of a relational God. What that means is that the primary thing that gives our lives meaning, the primary thing that fulfills us, is love relationships. That's why the closer we get to the end of our time in this life, the less we think about the degrees we have, or the times we won Employee of the Month, or the things that we individually accomplish. When you're on your deathbed, the only thing that matters is being surrounded with people that you love who love you. That's a part of what it means to be made in the image of God. So I say that to say this. When somebody says, as so many people do in our culture, and I don't mean this to sound offensive, I'm just trying to be logical here. When someone says, you know, when I die, they're going to put me in a box, and I'm going to rot. I'm going to become fertilizer. That's just the end of it, and I don't care about that. When somebody says that, here's what they are in effect saying. What they're saying is, when I die, after this handful of breaths that we call life, that's like a mist that appears and then it vanishes, what they're saying is, when I die, the one thing that makes my life meaningful, the one thing that fulfills me is going to be taken away from me forever. I'm not going to ever have any hope of getting it back, but I don't care. And to anybody who holds to that worldview, if I can just respectfully respond and push back a little by saying, I don't think you're being honest with yourself. It is, frankly, it is a terrifying thing to consider this worldview that we call secularism, this idea that we came from meaninglessness, no supernatural causes, that we're headed towards meaninglessness, that there's nothing after this life, and therefore, in the end, all human life is meaningless. It has no meaning. That's a worldview that, among other things, that offers you no resources in the midst of suffering. That's a resource that gives you no good reason to make any sacrifice for anyone else. Why would you do that if you only get one life? And most of all, that's a worldview that assigns absolutely no meaning to your existence or anyone else's whatsoever. And I bring this up because when you hold that vision of the future alongside the doctrine of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, you begin to see how beautiful the resurrection and its implications are. The doctrine of the resurrection, that Jesus Christ was physically raised with a physical body, that when he came back, he recognized his friends. His friends recognized him, although his body had been changed, no longer to be subject to death. That Jesus even ate a meal that first Easter morning with his disciples. And the promise of Scripture is that as Jesus was raised, so we will be raised. You know what all of that means? That means that when you give your life to Jesus, this is the hope that you have, then even after a profound a change as death in Jesus, even after death, you will still be you. And other people will still be them. What that means is that the resurrection of Jesus Christ offered us something that our hearts most deeply and primarily long for, which is a future in which we could have love relationships that will never end. Jesus has promised love without parting. That's the second thing that the resurrection means. The third thing that the resurrection means, however, is that we can actually have confidence that we're going to take part in this life. All right, let me just point something out here. It does no good to anybody to talk about how great this future is that Jesus has made available to us if we're not confident we're actually going to take part in this future. And when you look at Paul's sermon here in Acts 13, one of the main points of it, he's communicating to these people to let them know that because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, you can have confidence that you'll live to see this future. So look with me at verses 27 and 28. Paul says, "For the residents of Jerusalem and their rulers, since they did not recognize him or the voices of the prophets that are read every Sabbath, they fulfilled their words by condemning Jesus. Though they, this is important, though they found no grounds for the death penalty, they asked Pilate to have him killed." So Paul there, he's not just trying to make people in Jerusalem look bad. He's making a really important, actually a vitally important point. Paul is saying that though Jesus Christ was killed, he did not die for his own sins. That's important to understand. With that idea in mind, pivot down to verses 38 and 39. He says, "Therefore," so this is where he's making his point, "therefore, let it be known to you, brothers, that through this man, Jesus, forgiveness of sins is being proclaimed to you. And everyone who believes in him is justified from everything that you could not be justified from through the law of Moses." So here's the question. If Jesus did not die for his own sins, then whose sins did he die for? The answer, of course, is yours and mine. And what Paul is saying here is that in raising Jesus from the dead, what that was proof of, that wasn't just the display that Jesus was who he claimed to be, that was proof that the payment that Jesus' death was has been received by God, that it actually worked. Now, here's why this matters. To kind of explain this, this is sort of a goofy story, but I think you'll understand where I'm going. About a year and a half ago, I started taking violin lessons. You may have heard me mention that before. Katie gave that to me as a Christmas present. And as part of the present, she lined me up with a teacher who plays professionally for the BSO, the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. And I don't use this term loosely or carelessly, but genuinely, my violin instructor is a prodigy. He's been practicing for more than wrap your head around this. He's been practicing the violin for more than 3 hours a day from before his 7th birthday. Now, I have a six-year-old son right now, and so I can start to appreciate how insane it is that a six-year-old boy would practice the violin for 3 hours. But if you listen to this guy play, and he's my age now, if you listen to him play, you believe him. The sound, the beauty that he's able to pull out of that instrument is amazing. And actually, I'm getting ready to lose him because he just caught a promotion to Cincinnati. Everywhere he goes, you know, he's that guy. One of the things that I really appreciate about him, I guess I don't know how I'll feel if he ever listens to this message, but one of the things I like about him is he's not a nice guy. And what I mean by that is he will not tell you good job just to make you feel good. And we move through these books. They're called Suzuki books. It's the Suzuki method. And each one of the songs in the book is meant to teach you a very particular technique that's meant to build on what you've learned before. He will not let you move past a song unless he's convinced that you've learned what that song is meant to teach you. So he's kept me on songs for, in some cases, a mind-numbing length of time. But again, I appreciate that. I'm married with 4 kids. I serve on 2 boards. I'm a pastor of a growing church. I'm in school. My wife works overnight shifts. I don't have a whole lot of time on my hands. So I'm not driving from Severn, Maryland to his apartment in Baltimore City so he can tell me that I'm good at something I'm bad at. I'm driving to his apartment in Baltimore City so that I can get proficient at the violin, which is what he's, you know, that's what he's there for. The most frustrating thing of all, however, about our arrangement is that I can't play the violin in front of this guy. He just makes me too nervous. So I'll practice my songs in between lessons to the point that I know he would pass me. I know that it's acceptable according to his high standards, but something happens between the drive from Severn, Maryland to Baltimore City where whatever was in my brain leaves it. And I feel his judgmental gaze on me when I pull my violin out. And literally, I've told Katie, it would actually be humiliating to me for you all to see how nervous I am. Way more nervous playing the violin in front of this guy than I am preaching to you all. I can feel my breath rate increase, my heart slamming against my sternum, my hands shake. I forget everything that I practice for one specific reason. And now you see where I'm going with this. It's because when I enter into his presence, follow me here. When I enter into his presence, I feel how far I fall short. Right, as far as I'm concerned, musically speaking, my instructor, he is perfect. He's mastered techniques. Before he was 10 years old, I haven't even started practicing yet. He just doesn't make mistakes as far as my ears. Perfect intonation, perfect technique. You know, he's a professional. He's the consummate prodigy. And so the closer that I get to him, the more his perfection brings out all of my imperfection. And I tell you this story because it's a great analogy of what we're all like before God. You read the story of Scripture, Genesis to Revelation, and it's filled with stories of men and women who begin to get close to God, or God begins to get close to them. They begin to catch just a glimpse, just a faint whisper of his glory, his perfection, and his radiance. And what you'll see, I think Isaiah in the temple is probably the best example of this. What you'll see is that when the reality of God dawns on them, they're not having a good time anymore. It's not fun for them. It's not like a kumbaya kind of scenario. Isaiah said, woe is me, I'm undone. They start coming apart. They start trembling. They need to actually be commanded, fear not. That's the most common command in the entire Bible, fear not. Every time God comes near somebody, he literally has to say, stop being so afraid. Why? Because the closer we get to God, the more in touch we become with something that we all quietly sense, we just live most of our lives trying to distract ourselves from, which is that we fall short. We know we do. And what we usually do is we spend our time either distracting ourselves or medicating ourselves in light of that quiet sense that we all have in our own hearts. Nobody appreciated this idea more than Paul. Because before becoming a follower of Jesus, Paul was literally working himself to death as a religious man, trying to keep all the rules. And I'll tell you, and Paul would tell you, it's not because he was confident that God loved him, it's because he was terrified that he hadn't done enough. So he had to do more, and he had to do more, and he had to do more. And it turned him into this ugly person that leveraged his beliefs and turned them into violence toward other people, all the while thinking that that would somehow secure him a place in God's family, only to find out how wrong he was on the road to Damascus. So watch this. That same Paul who caused so much pain, that same Paul, about 35 years later, he wrote in a letter known as Philippians that he could not wait to stand in the presence of God. In Philippians, he's writing to people that he loved, and he says, hey, I know my time on earth is coming to an end. I know I'm getting ready to die a martyr's death. And Paul says, I'm torn. Because on the one hand, if I stick around, I could be way more useful to you all, and I love serving Jesus and leading people to love him. But on the other hand, to die is far better, because then I'll finally see him face to face. That's where he said this iconic phrase, to live is Christ, but to die, Paul said, is gain. So here's the question I have when I read those words. How could somebody like Paul, who had ruined so many people's lives, who had caused so much pain that could never be undone, who had wounded people in ways they'd never recover from this side of eternity, how could somebody with that much red in his ledger have any confidence about the day that he stood before God? You know what the answer is? It's the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The resurrection of Jesus Christ says you don't have to wonder whether or not you've done enough for God. This is where Christianity and every other belief system part ways entirely. Christianity alone says that God's love for you does not depend in any way, shape, or form on what you've done. It depends entirely on what Jesus Christ has done for you. That he lived a perfect life in your and my place. And he died on the cross for your and my sins. And he was raised 3 days later as the living proof that that payment was efficacious. It worked. God has accepted it. And so in Jesus, we never have to fear evaluation. So back to my goofy violin analogy. Just imagine this. And maybe this will be a light bulb moment for somebody. Imagine if the next time I was up for evaluation with the violin. Imagine if the next time I had to play a song that I've been working on, or I had to do a recital, or I had to sit for a chair, you know, auditioning for a spot in an orchestra. Imagine all the nerves that I would feel, you know, the weight of that evaluation, those judgmental eyes and ears on me. And imagine if when it came time to play, my violin instructor played in my place. He sat in the chair. He bore the evaluation. He bore up under scrutiny. Imagine how nervous I'd feel. I wouldn't feel nervous at all. Because here's a perfect musician perfectly playing in my place. And the point is, that's how followers of Jesus are meant to move through life. We move through life completely free from the fear of evaluation, knowing that we hold up under scrutiny, knowing that we can never be condemned. Why? Because Jesus stands in our place. Because he lives, our hope lives. And when God looks at us, he doesn't see our failures. He sees the perfect, sinless righteousness of Jesus Christ staring him in the face. So not only did the resurrection of Jesus prove there is a future and that that future is a one where we'll know love without parting, the resurrection means you and I, by grace through faith in the name of Jesus, can know with confidence we will live to take part in that future. This leads us to our fourth and our final implication of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The resurrection means that regret will never have the final word. We are beginning the end of our time together. So what I wanted to do, kind of what I did last time, is I want to conclude, take a few minutes to walk through it, but I want to conclude with a personal story, and then I want to talk to two specific groups of people that I think are listening to this. So what I mean when I say that the resurrection means regret will never have the final word, the best story I have to illustrate the principle is as follows. So back in 2021, I was invited to teach chapel at my son's school for the first time. And he was in first grade, my oldest son. He's entering middle school in just a couple weeks now, but he was in first grade at the time. And since this was the first time that I'd ever taught, I thought it'd be a cool idea to surprise him. So the principal came to me, and he said he wanted me to teach on the concept that God's love protects us. And so I instantly knew what I wanted to do. I was going to bring my turnout gear that I still have for my day's firefighting with me that day that I taught chapel. I was going to call Everett up on stage, and I was going to dress him up in my turnout gear, because I used to do that, you know, part of your job, especially when you're the rookie in the fire department. You go to elementary schools, you dress kids up, and, you know, they love it. So I was going to dress Everett up, and I was going to explain God's love protects us the way that a firefighter's gear protects them. And I was actually pretty nervous because, of course, you know, I want to make my son look good. I want him to be proud of me, all that kind of stuff. And kindergarten through fifth grade is actually a tougher audience to preach to than you all, for being perfectly honest. Anyway, the day for me to do chapel arrived, and I went up on the stage. I had my bag full of gear, and I announced what we were going to do, and I called Everett up with me. So we're going to dress Everett up in my turnout gear, and everybody cheered except Everett. So Everett looked out at all of his classmates, kindergarten through fifth grade. He looked at the gear. He looked at me and he said, "I don't want to do this." And then he walked off the stage, which I pride myself on being pretty quick on my feet up here, but I did not plan for that. I didn't have a contingency plan, so it got a little awkward and I kind of froze. Thankfully, the principal was fast on his feet. And so he called up some fifth grade kid that I'd never met before. He said, "Hey, dress him up." I said, "Great." I didn't bring out the gear for nothing. We dressed up the unnamed fifth grader, and the day went on. It was an anticlimactic thing for me, and I told Katie on the way home I was a little bummed out about how it went. But my son's in first grade. You can't hold that against him. That'd be ridiculous, too. So anyway, the day went the way that it went. That night, my wife, who's a nurse, was working an overnight shift at the hospital, and so I was alone with, we only had three kids at the time. So I was at the house, and I'd gotten everybody in bed, and I was laying in bed, cooling down for the evening, and Everett walked into my room. At the time, Everett shared a bedroom with his younger sister, Scarlett, and so when he got up, of course, she got up, and somewhere in the ruckus, they woke up our third-born son, Hayes. Hayes had a nickname when he was a couple years younger. I called him Hurricane Hayes, and he earned that nickname. Hayes did not sleep through the night for the first years of his life, so waking him up after he was asleep was a cardinal sin in my home, punishable by death. So I was upset, all fired up. I got everybody back to bed, and when I was putting Everett back down, it was obvious something was on his mind. So I said, "What's up, buddy?" And Everett, 6 years old, hand to God, 6 years old, Everett said something to me he never said before. He said, "Dad, I'd like to speak to you in private." So I was actually kind of nervous, like he's like he's going to ground me or something. So I said, "All right, let's do it, buddy." So we walked into my room, and I have this recliner, it's a rocking chair, and I sat in the rocking chair, and I'll never forget, little six-year-old Everett was standing in front of me, and he was pacing back and forth. And he was looking at the ground, and he was kind of fidgeting with his hands. You could tell that he was nervous, and he talked to me about, you know, how the day went and how upset he was about the way that it went. And there was a specific phrase that Ev said. As soon as he said it, he started to cry. He said, "I regret it." He kept saying, "I regret it." He told me he regretted that it was some other kid instead of him up there with me, for one reason, because he knew we couldn't get that day back. So I picked up Everett and I played like every card that I know to play as a dad. I apologized to him. I said, "Buddy, that is my fault. It's not your fault. I'd have done the same thing. I'm just like you. I'd have been nervous. I should have told you what was going on so you had a chance to, you know, get comfortable with it. Just don't worry about it. You know, we're going to get, you know, all that kind of stuff." And if I can get kind of vulnerable here for a moment, there's lots of things I see in my son that remind me of my wife. Lots of things. But in that moment, I had never seen more of myself in my son. Because I'm 38 years old now, and there are so many things in my life that I regret. You know, sometimes you hear people talk about no regrets. I think that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. There are so many things in my life that I regret. There are so many things I've done that I wish I haven't done. There are so many things I wish I'd had the strength to do that I didn't do. So many things that I just wish I could get back and they would have gone differently. And that night, what I saw, as a first grade kid, I saw the weight of the human condition beginning to kind of rest on my son's shoulders. What do I mean when I say the human condition? Here's the weight of the human condition. The time is always moving forward. There's nothing we can do about it. Time is always moving forward. Things so rarely go the way that we want them to. And at the end of it all, we're all just trying to find a way to deal with regret over the things that we've done in time that we can't get back. Tim Keller spoke to this idea in a book that he wrote when he was newly diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. It's called Hope in Times of Fear. And it's all about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I'd highly recommend anybody that wants to go deeper in this subject to read this. But here's what Keller had to say. He said, "As a pastor, I've spoken to people nearing death who express guilt and shame for things they'd done. But I've spoken to far more people who were racked with regret for the things they'd not done. They realized at the end that much of their lives had been simply wasted and that their lives warranted a negative verdict. This regret assails non-religious persons as much as, if not more than, religious ones. We live with this invisible weight. When we're younger, we may say, 'Nobody has the right to tell me how to live. Nobody has the right to make me feel guilty. Only I judge myself. But even within that framework, as the years mount, we see that we've not lived up to our own standards. The burden barely noticed at first gets heavier as the years go by. For more religious people, that may be guilt over specific sins they've done. For non-religious people, it may be a less specific, shameful sense of not being the persons they should be. So what does any of that have to do with the resurrection of Jesus Christ? The answer is everything, absolutely everything. Listen, if you try to move through this life, if you try to deal with the disappointments of life and the reality of death, believing that when you die, you rot, that no one's coming for us, that no one's going to fix what we intuitively sense is wrong, that one day we're going to nuke ourselves into oblivion or the sun's just going to burn out and that'll be the end of this tale told by an idiot that we call human history. If that's what you believe, then what you and I are left with at the end of our lives is nothing but regret. But the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I'm here to tell you, says no to regret. Because the resurrection is not just a consolation for the life that you've lost, it's the restoration of the life you always wanted but never had down here. It's even a religion that promises heaven, that promises that your soul will somehow continue on in bliss. All that is, all that's offering you is a consolation. But Jesus Christ stands to offer you more because the resurrection is the restoration of the life you've always wanted but never had. The resurrection says that you're going to get your body back, not your old body, but the one you always wanted but never had. In the resurrection, you're going to get your relationships back, the ones you've always wanted but never had. The resurrection says you're going to get your life back, the one you've always wanted but never had. The resurrection says Everett and I are going to get that moment back. And I don't know how Jesus is going to do it, but he's going to do it. He's either going to give us that or he's going to give us something even better, and he's going to do the same for you by grace through faith in his name. That's what I mean when I say the resurrection means that regret will never have the final word, not in our lives, not in Jesus. So let me call the worship team up, and I'll close down just talking to two groups of people. Most of the people listening to this message, you're already Christians, you already believe this. I haven't actually told you anything new today. Maybe you've heard it in a way you hadn't heard it before, but you knew all of this before you came in. The problem is it's not real. It's not so real to you that it's changing how you live, and that's where most of us live most of their lives. And if that's where you're coming from this morning, I just want to point out there's a reason that Peter and Paul and all of the first followers of Jesus, when they publicly communicated their faith, one of the only things that all of their messages had in common was they centered them around the resurrection of Jesus Christ. You get the idea that they never stopped thinking about it. They never stopped talking about it. They never stopped reminding themselves and each other of the resurrection and what it means. It's because when it takes root in your life, it gives you the strength to face the disappointment of life and the reality of death, knowing that on the other side of eternity, what's waiting for you in Jesus is not just a consolation for what you've lost, but the restoration of what you've always longed for. So the application, if that's where you're coming from this morning, is simply do everything you can to drive the truth of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection more deeply into your heart. That means despite whatever else you have going on in your life, make the decision to gather with God's people every 7 days and choose to worship with them. It means seek out relationships with other people that are serious about growing in the image of Jesus. Small groups are getting ready to start off. That's a great way to find those relationships. It means get up early in the morning, even when you don't want to open that love letter that we call the Bible and pray the Psalms. Do whatever you need to drive the truth of the gospel more deeply into your heart. It's the only hope that we have. But secondly and finally, I'm sure there's people listening to this who you're on the fence about Christianity. Maybe somebody invited you and you're giving this a shot, but you're not really sure what you think. Or maybe you've been in this for a while. You can look back at a time when maybe you were kind of, you know, spiritually on fire, but there's been a disillusionment in your life for one reason or the other. And maybe you haven't even told anybody, but you're thinking about walking away from this. You're not even sure if you believe it anymore. If that's where you're coming from, I'll just leave you with this thought. If after everything you've heard today, if you don't find yourself at least wanting to believe this, if you don't find yourself at least wanting to believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ and in the hope of your resurrection by grace through faith in his name. If you don't find yourself at least wanting to believe that, I don't think you've understood this old story that we call the gospel yet. And my hope for you and my ask to you is, would you please keep coming back until you do understand it? Because when you do, Paul the Apostle is the living historical testimony that it will change your life like nothing else can. But it all stems from us understanding the resurrection of Jesus Christ, both as a historical fact and the fulfillment of a promise that God's made to us. That's it. That's all. Let me pray for us. Lord Jesus, there's not a single one of us, myself included, who believes what we just talked about deeply enough. Some of us might need to believe it for the very first time in our lives, but most of us probably just need to believe it in a deeper and more life-changing way. So by the power of your Holy Spirit, Father, would you open our eyes? Would you soften our hearts so that the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus and all that it means would sink more deeply into our hearts and become the foundation of our lives so that we could have the strength and the hope and the joy and the confidence and the buoyancy necessary to live this life well, to live this life in a way that honors you. Please make us a community of people who live confident that as Jesus was raised, so we will be raised. By grace through faith in his name. Amen.